What up, what up, everybody? It's Double G for the Fight Game podcast with John LaRocca here on a Friday night. We are one day late, and it is my fault, though it is because I was stuck in traffic on the way from the Bay Area to Arizona, Tucson, where my parents live. I decided to take the plunge, do the 12-hour drive, because just on principle, I wasn't going to pay for these crappy flights that were available. And within that 12-hour drive, there was a 3-hour traffic accident. So my 12-hour drive became a 15-hour drive. So I didn't get home in time to do the show with John last night, but we're back. We're back tonight, so we're able to do it. But John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great. The missus and I went out date night. Uh-oh. Had some good sushi. You know our spot.
St. Patrick's Day sushi.
St. Patrick. Yeah, we celebrate the Irish by eating some sushi tonight. It was great. Then we went a little wild. Trader Joe's. And then the wife right next to across from Trader Joe's is this big sign, ROSS, Ross. Yeah. No, that's her addiction, man. And she was like, do you want to go home or do you want to go to Ross? I was like, let's go home. Then I saw her face. All right, let's go to Ross. She's looking at me right now. She's going to throw me daggers at me right now.
Hey, man, you guys have been married for a long time. It's mm-hmm. working. Whatever you guys are doing, it's working. All right, so what are we going to do tonight? I have a hour segment that I did with the great Robert Silva, who I don't think has been on this feed since we moved over to F4W, but back in the day on our old feed, he would come on regularly to talk, and he hosts the Pound for Pound podcast, the boxing podcast on our feed. He and I talked Creed 3 and the Creed universe and the Rocky universe for about an hour. So when this segment cuts off, we're going to go to that segment. And if you have no interest in Creed 3 whatsoever, it will not hurt my feelings if you just turn the show off. However, if you have even a small interest, you may get some you may find some interesting things that Robert and I talk about as the Creed universe is upon us. I think they're doing something with Amazon and MGM, and we may see some Creed related TV series.
Holy
another
cow.
Movie for sure. But yeah, it's going to happen. It's coming. So we talk about that.
Spinoff series?
Yes. They set it up, man. They got characters.
I still got to watch Creed 1.
Creed 1 is
I'm surprised
awesome.
I haven't even seen. I mean, I'm so behind a lot of stuff.
So what are we going to do tonight? So we have that hour segment. John and I are not going to overstay our welcome here on a Friday evening. As we're both kind of tired, too. Like, you know, date night and sushi, I can imagine, you know, in about a half an hour, you're going to start feeling it. And yeah, I'm still kind of tired from that drive yesterday. Yeah. So we're just going to do our thumbs up, thumbs down. We'll do our big picture about Dynamite, and then we're going to be done. And so then we'll move on to the Creed segment. All right. So we might as well kick it off with
thumbs up, thumbs down.
So do you want to start or do you want me to start this week?
Yeah, I'll start. I'll start with my thumbs up. My thumbs up has just been the build to Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes. I think they've been doing a lot of smart things with Cody. The last thing I saw, I think it was on – I didn't watch Raw. I missed Raw. Oh, no, I did watch Raw. He wrestled. I did watch his match at LA Knight. Thought it was a very solid – match, you know, LA Knight's really good and Cody just had a really good match. But I enjoyed what I saw on SmackDown, where it was kind of that is this big old brawl with the Usos and they go in the crowd. And it was pretty hot little fight, I thought. And then just how smart Cody is, the raising of the hand of Sammy at the end, you know, like to the crowd. Like it's just this crowd won't. People are like, oh, Crow's gonna get booed. No, man. I think he's playing this. They're playing the game smart, and I don't know. Just really impressed with it because, as we've seen, you know, last 10 years or whatever it was, you know, the crowd could like pick who they want and start, you know, booing the guy the company wants because the company's forcing him down our throat. But I always thought Roman Reigns got the short end of the stick on that one. But
oh yeah.
But yeah, I think Cody's been playing the game really smart, and same thing with the booking as well. So I'm looking forward to WrestleMania. Really am.
I forget. I think it's maybe Lance Storm who said that the thing that people are overlooking is that the company themselves is no longer the heel to the fan base.
Yes.
And the fan base is generally happy with the product. So they may be more willing to go with whatever the plan is. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I think Cody's doing some smart things. I still think he may be going a little overboard with some of these promos, but I think the crowd has been okay with them because they're very passionate. I worry a little bit that, you know, every promo doesn't necessarily have to have his promo voice or his like we know the plan. We've known the plan since Royal Rumble, and that that promo that he cut, you know, the next day, and then the one that he did with Heyman, that was awesome. And I'm like, okay, I'm good. You can't really recreate that, but I think because of the things that we've said, people are into it, giving him benefit of the doubt, pairing him with Sammy, raising Sammy's hand. I think all that stuff has been really good. And I haven't watched tonight's SmackDown yet, but our good friend John Muse, friend of the show, friend of Big Dave, awesome. He sent me a note and said that he thought the build was really good as well.
Oh, I thought you say he was going to be there as well, because we got Paul Fontaine at Dynamite in the house.
No,
shout out to Paul, our local reporter, is always on scene when it comes to the Winnipeg cards.
Yeah, no, he was pumped up for that show.
Yeah.
So my thumbs up, and, you know, this is not an ass kissing in any way here, but there are a couple of things that happened over the week that made me realize that, you know, we may be taking Big Dave Meltzer for granted here, and his really his what he created, and I'll lay it out. I was listening to the Bill Simmons podcast, and he had former WWE writer and now employee of The Rock's company, Brian Gewirtz. He had him on, and they were talking about a bunch of different things, but it came down, you know, we talked about this betting thing the other day, and, you know, I don't think it's going to actually happened because it just seems too hard. But he was saying, yeah, you know, if we didn't have someone like Meltzer, then maybe you could actually do the betting thing because the results get out. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, he had some interesting information on who is to blame for Dave getting his reporting and such. And what I realized as I was listening to this podcast is, if not for Dave and his reporting and his insight and the ability for me to read it sort of an insider's newsletter, I don't think I'd be watching wrestling today. I think I would. It would have passed me by probably right after the Attitude Era. I would have got back into it because my friends were into it during the Attitude Era. Because, you know, you and I have talked about this. Mm-hmm. Like 1991, even though like business was kind of down, 1992, I was so big into wrestling because I had a little bit of a taste of that insight. You know, we're finding information out here and there. Dynamite D, we've talked about him. But then, you know, finish high school, go to college, and wrestling kind of sucks. Like, it's really, I don't really feel like it's for me at that point. Yeah. And then after I graduate from college, Attitude Era happens, then I graduate from college. And then I subscribed to The Observer, and that kind of kept me into it. I don't think I would be doing this podcast today without Meltzer. And so the other thing that I talked to somebody today out in Tucson, there's a subscriber. His name is Nicholas De Leon. He's also a tech writer. And he and I, he'll tweet at me, and we'll talk about certain sports media stuff. Like we were talking about F1 back then and back in the day. And I went out to dinner with him just to kind of shoot the stuff, because I'm out here in Tucson and he lives in Tucson. And so he became a journalist because he read The Observer. Like, Dave literally gave him a pathway to to his career. And, you know, he's doing really good for himself. So it just kind of hit me like, man, you know, Dave is Dave. And, you know, and then he gets his Twitter hacked and everything this week. So he hasn't had the best of weeks. But
is that what happened?
Yeah, his Twitter got hacked. Like his email got hacked too, but I helped him get back into the email. I couldn't help him get back into the Twitter.
Oh, I saw his name was weird or something, and I was like, what's Dave's doing? He must have clicked on something freaking out, but all right. Yeah, I've been off social media a lot today, so I haven't really seen too much, but wow.
But anyway, it just reminded me of like, man, you know, this guy created an entire industry for people to, you know, to have a successful website. And just wanted to, so he's my thumbs up for this week. All right, what about thumbs down?
I don't want to bag on anyone, but really disappointed with the local Northern California wrestling community. I'm not saying it's not fans. It's a lot of jealous wrestlers.
Really?
I've seen some posts and some comments about the recent tapings of Dynamite, Rampage. You know, when WWE comes to town, when AEW comes to town, they use local talent for they're, you know, doing some jobs or extra work. And I've seen some people bag on it, you know. And that's just straight up jealousy. And the people who are bagging are the people that are, they're happy to be weekend warriors and think they're big stars and in their own little minds. But, you know, I think it's great those kids are taking chances, getting seen, you know. One person even mentioned on Twitter, like, well, does it really benefit him for just, you know, throwing a couple punches and getting suplexed and losing or something like that? And I'm like, it's not just the match. It's their attitude. It's how they execute the directions that the producer gave them and how the talent that worked with them thought about their work and they could get a good word. Like, you just never know what could happen. You might not even be using a match and you can impress someone in the back or press someone in training in the morning before the show starts, just get in the ring and do some things. Like, there's so many ways to get noticed, and it's just an opportunity. But you got to be there. You got to get there.
Yep.
And these guys and gals did, and I just, you know, commend them for taking chances because they're trying to better themselves in their wrestling career. They don't want to just stick around the local area, you know, and hold the replica title belts to turn into, you know, indie belts. You know, they want to do more. So those guys and girls on the AEW shows from local talent, you know, my hat's off to you guys. And for you, the guys and gals are jealous of them, screw you. Take a chance.
Yeah, it's about networking and relationships and talking to people. And, you know, and you can't overstay your welcome, right? Because that's not necessarily your locker room. But,
yeah.
You know, you make those connections and somebody may see something, and, you know, and that's positive to me. I mean, as long as you can do it, as long as you can, you know, I'm sure, you know, you're have a regular job, get the time off from your regular job. That's an investment in time and in you as a performer and as a wrestler. So yeah, I think that stuff is really cool as well. Okay. Thumbs down for me. Do you know that AEW is running a house show this week? Their debut house show in Troy, Ohio.
I've seen some matches announced and I didn't realize it's going to be this weekend, but the card hasn't really like, oh man, I got to go see these matches, you know, a bunch of tag matches and stuff I've been seeing, but I do know they're getting up on this trial of house show runs. Yeah.
So I will admit, I still have a bad taste in my mouth from the Rampage card that I actually paid money to. Okay.
That fucking Rampage card we're going to talk about for the rest of our lives. I didn't go, thank God. But
That is like one of my defining wrestling moments there is going to that Rampage show. Though, you know, I did get to hang out with our buddy Richard Becerra and Corey. And so that was fun. The wrestling card in itself was terrible. But so I may be a little biased towards this. And, you know, when you think about adding a possible revenue stream to what, you know, you're still a very young business. Here is your debut lineup. Now, what I hope is that there's going to be lots of fun surprises on the show. So I will say I'm hopeful that that happens, but this is just what they are selling. So to people who live in Troy, Ohio, maybe you're just interested in seeing AEW live, but let's say that you're on the fence of seeing AEW live. This is what they're selling you. Darby Allin and Orange Cassidy versus The Butcher and The Blade. Dr. Britt Baker, DMD, versus Anna Jay. And the Blackpool Combat Club of Claudio and John Moxley versus Big Bill and Lee Moriarty. Those are the only three matches that have been announced. Wow. Wow. So if you're trying to sell this show to maybe an edge case customer, I don't know. I think you're not doing a good job in that sense, because that doesn't yell to me that we want this first show to just be a giant success.
No,
there could be some sort of test or experiment thing, you know, because WWE, remember how WWE used to have, and they still have it somewhat, but they used to have like the three tours. Yeah. And, you know, at the San Jose Civic, we would get the C tour because that building's only like 2,000 seats or whatever. And so maybe it could be some of that. They're like, oh, we're not going to throw like the A show out there because this is a C building or whatever. But I just feel like if it's your first attempt at running a house show, like this should be a special show. Like Troy, Ohio, this is historic. First ever. Oh, actually, it's technically second house AEW house show, I think.
Yeah, they did.
But like.
Yeah,
but like, you know, this is the start of a new era. We're doing house shows, Troy. You're the first one. We're going to give you a killer show. And then in 9 months, we're going to come back and that Troy crowd is going to be like, that was an awesome show. We're definitely coming back. So maybe it will still be an awesome show. I just don't know that this is the card that I would put out there if I was trying to, you know, get on. And I don't even know who to blame. I mean, ultimately, Tony Khan sort of has to take the blame on everything because that's just his job. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they brought in Jeff Jarrett to help out with this stuff. And he's like the director of, I forgot what he said that his title was when we talked to him a few Night weeks ago.
Or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just would have figured that it would have been way more of like an A lineup on their first try.
Do you think possibly when it came to this lineup and why it looks so weak? Because Tony Khan's kind of painted himself in a corner with his booking. He doesn't like to do rematches. He doesn't like to, and he's probably a little afraid to give away some big matches on these house shows. And they're not filmed.
Yeah, so they're not filmed.
You can run these big matches, do some trial matches, you know, like you get people ready. You can maybe, I mean, you don't do singles matches with a lot of these guys, but you can at least have Moxley and Claudio and Yuta versus the Young Bucks or something like that, and Kenny Omega. And but you know, I'm sure there's gonna be cameras, people taking film, but you know, just working out stuff, or you know, just doing a house show match, you know, with those guys. And at least it feels like a big match, right? Or these stars are in it. Lee Moriarty and Big Bill, you see that? I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think he might be a little afraid, like, oh, I don't know, you know, I don't want to waste something on a house show. I need to save it for Dynamite. I need to save it for a pay-per-view. You know, but that's where like WWE gets it right. Like, you know, after WrestleMania, you get WrestleMania rematches down, you know, and you get, you know, pretty big matches and pretty big stars and matches. So to be the success the second time around, I'm sure I don't know how the tickets are doing this weekend, but I mean, you can look up probably WrestleTix, but you know, I think that by next second time around through Troy, Ohio, how's that going to look? Are you, but you know, it's going to be either who you come back with, Danhausen versus Satnam in the main event, you know?
Well, you can't because Danhausen's hurt now.
That guy gets hurt a lot.
I know. Poor guy. Because
I think he might just be the just the kind of guy on the outside, you know? I don't know. He should be wrestling.
Yeah, because, you know, the injuries that he gets are, like, really, really bad ones. It's not like, you know, stinger or, you know, shoulder like Ospreay where you're like, oh, yeah, he can probably come back. But, yeah, bad luck for him because it's clear. It's pretty clear he's, you know, he's over with a good part of that fan base. And the wrestling is the thing that they kind of save for the one time that they use him, and he just keeps getting hurt. Sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's get right into our AEW recap. And just a reminder to folks, you know, we're no longer doing the match by match. I mean, it's already Friday. Usually when we do it, it's Thursday. All the takes have already been out there. And so we're looking more big picture. We're looking more, you know, wide view angle lens of the show versus our granular view that we used to do. So let's talk about that next.
The big picture.
Justin Nipper on production there. Justin,
I'm glad you didn't tell me what we had going on. That fucking popped me. The big picture. You should have me do that Ole Anderson voice. Scorpion, Black Scorpion voice.
Oh man, that would have been good. Yeah, I was thinking of like what could we use, and I'm sure Justin just like put some sort of thing on his own voice, but yeah, that would have been a good idea too. The Black Scorpion voice. Okay, I want to start with the opening segment of this show, which was MJF and three possible contenders for whoever gets the next match. And it is, in fact, the four pillars. And I know you are talking about that on your Take It Home show in the Fight Game Media Network. I watched that segment. It was very clear where they were going. I got it. WWE used to do this every once in a while where it's like, okay, we've been giving you the old guys time after time after time. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, Jericho's getting a title shot? Like, what's going on here? Like, Jericho's an intercontinental guy. You know, oh, Benoit, bad. That was a bad example. But, you know, all of a sudden, young guy would get a shot, right? And so I was like, oh, this is actually okay. And it's an interesting idea. But after that segment was over, my thought was, they don't actually have three contenders here. They have one. The other two guys were kind of bad in their promo attempt. I thought Jungle Boy was really bad. I thought Sammy was pretty bad. Some of it was the verbiage and some of it was the language that they use. You know, Sammy's the what did he call himself?
The
bump guy. Was he Jericho's bump guy or something?
I thought they said job guy or something. Maybe he did say bump guy. Either way, he used a lot of inside terms and you know, it was really cringeworthy and but yeah. But Darby, I thought, was overall pretty good. Nice to hear Darby with some bass in his voice and some oomph instead of being
I kind of in the back of my mind, I'm wondering now if this was like a real competition, right? If this was like a meritocracy here, and you're like Tony Khan, you're like, okay, guys, three of you are going out there, not even sure who's going to get the match, but let's see who does the best or whatever. Like Darby clearly won that. Yeah. That and thing. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that he's the one that does it. I'm hopeful that this is not an actually going to be like a four way or something. Because I think it was clear that Darby is just a step ahead of those guys when it comes to the presentation of being a main eventer, when it comes to really grabbing that crowd and having the crowd be behind you, when it comes to having someone like Sting in your corner to add to that presentation. Like to me, it's MJF and Darby, you know, whenever they're going to do it, that should be the match. Like, you know, I love Jungle Boy. You love Jungle Boy. He's out of his league. The promo about, you know, him losing the match and going to Dark and Dark Elevation. I was like, dude.
Just burying their YouTube show.
Well, not only that, but burying yourself. Like, let's say that happened, right? Let's say that. You know, you lose this match and now all of a sudden you're doing Dark and Dark Elevation. Guess who doesn't watch Dark and Dark Elevation? Me and John LaRocca. So we would have not even known unless you just told us right now that you were on Dark and Dark Elevation. So I thought it was silly. It was very amateurish. And same with Sammy. I thought he and Jack looked like wannabes and Darby looked like a star. So if that was the point of the segment, they did a really good job, but I don't think that was the point of the segment.
I think it's going to be a four-way. I don't know if it's going to be on the pay-per-view. I think it might be just a big television main event. Maybe one of those guys will break off, and maybe that will be the main event, singles main event, the pay-per-view. But I think Tony has, you know, this idea that he, you know, because he had this, you know, because he's a fan of the All Japan and their four pillars, and he, you know, these are my four pillars, these young guys.
Yeah.
But even though that was set up, what, maybe the year one of AEW, but over time, Jungle Boy's lost a lot of momentum, though he did have a really good pay-per-view match with Christian and all that. So Sammy Guevara, this last year, as I mentioned on the podcast coming up this weekend, when I go into more detail about this segment, then hasn't done much at all. Some of it's his own doing because of, you know, backstage altercations with Andrade and Eddie Kingston. But those guys are just not ready for this spot. Darby, I can buy it. But at the same time, I feel like Darby, we just saw Darby lose to Samoa Joe. I think both of these guys kind of need to, all three of these guys, excuse me, kind of need to have been put on that path upwards. And I think he should have went with someone else. And the guy I believe he should have went with someone else is feuding with the guy from the Bullet Club. So, you know, I was thinking that guy. Or maybe even Adam Cole, who hasn't done anything yet, but we don't know when he's going to be ready. He's going to, you know, so.
What if they do a triple threat and the winner of the triple threat gets the MJF match and it's the buffer until the pay-per-view, right? Because we still have over 2 months until we get to that pay-per-view. So let's say in a month, they do a title match at some gimmick Dynamite show with a cool, you know, a cool name for the show. And maybe that's where we get the title match. Does it change your thought process on how they did what they did on Wednesday?
If it's a free TV match? Yeah, I'll be a little softened on it, maybe. But I still think he could have went with someone else. You know, Ricky Starks, I feel like, is the guy that probably should have got that spot coming off that win off Chris Jericho. Jungle Boy's but a guy you just need to keep building up, you know?
Going back to what you said, though, about how, you know, Tony may be a little more apprehensive to do rematches. Ricky got, you could say Ricky got his shot at Max, right? He got his shot at Max. Yeah, on the TV. So then you'd run that match back again, and it doesn't seem like that is the way that he books.
But now you have a guy that on his resume within your company has beaten Chris Jericho, your first champion, twice. And you could just feel this audience. They love Ricky Starks. They love him way more than Sammy Guevara, way more than Jungle Boy. And probably about the same or just maybe a little bit more at this time than Darby Allin.
I would say Darby has a very interesting relationship with the fan base. Yeah. But if it comes to who is hotter right now, Starks probably got him by a little bit for sure.
Yeah. So, and it's a shame too. This could have been Wardlow's spot if he was kept hot, you know, building to this point. There, again, I mentioned Adam Cole, but he's hurt. But yeah, I think Starks is the guy I would have gone with. Jungle Boy is a guy you need to build up. You know, I know Jungle Boy's goal is to win the title, a singles title, but you know what's more his speed? The TNT title, right? Mm-hmm. Sammy, I have seen zero improvement from him in a very long time. You know, he was this guy that has so much potential as a heel, as a baby face, but I think more as a heel because he has that slappable face. He has the hot girlfriend that you get jealous because he has a hot girlfriend and she looks, she has a bitchy face. Like, they're just a heat magnet duo.
Yeah.
And they're just doing nothing. I don't know how she's at. I don't know if they're even together anymore. I don't know. But
I think she had gotten hurt, actually.
She got hurt. God, yeah. So many people hurt in that company. But, you know, like, I think they didn't do much with him for a whole year. And then Darby, like I said, he just came off that lost to Samoa Joe, that weird TNT title run for like just because he's in Seattle and he had to win the belt there and he could just win a match on at Seattle and kept Samoa Joe strong, you know, going into that match with Wardlow. I don't know. But of the three, I would go with Darby Allin. One, because he just, moreover, fans love him. He has a unique charisma. You could throw stuff with Sting in there with MGF. That would be fun and interesting. I thought Darby did a great job with that promo. Like, we want this promo, Darby. We don't want you making, I don't know, weird, you know, artistic videos and and your monotone like promos backstage. Like, this is guy, I want to see some more oomph out of this guy.
Yeah, no, I think this is the way to go, right? You could still do some of those goofy promo videos like for special matches or whatever.
Yeah.
But this, you know, this showed that he's kind of got the goods where you get the opportunity to show that off. And he, I thought he showed it off really well.
It looked like he was the one that really wanted it. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you can go like.
Honestly,
I'm assuming it's Darby, but you mentioned four way. I think a lot of people think four way.
Yeah, it's gonna be four way.
Yes, switch gears, man. There was one guy who did a great job here.
I think Darby clearly went out there and said, "You know what? I'm gonna eat these other guys alive." Probably, he probably can't hit. He can't compete with Max on the mic.
Yeah, yeah.
But he can show Tony like, I'm way ahead of these guys. You know, you should have just stuck with me now instead of making me be sharing the spotlight with them too, you know?
Yeah. All right, let's move on to a question that I have for you. I was in the arena watching Jon Moxley and Hangman Page like destroy each other and destroy the idea of what the matches after them could possibly do for pinfalls and kickouts. I thought that match was like, okay, Hangman had a bit of a rough going. Let's rejuvenate him. Let's get him back up. Let's get him back to be a main event guy. So they do that match. Hangman wins. And then the very next day on TV, they're back doing the same thing that they did before that match. And so then on this show, there's just a trios match with Hangman's team with the Dark Order. Stu Grayson was back against the BCC. And at the end of that match, and at the end of the show, I mean, the show was clearly to tease that the Elite had his back.
Yeah.
But when it comes to Mox and Hangman, like, it feels like we're it really feels like we didn't advance to where I thought we were advancing. And maybe Hangman isn't going to be like a top contender, and maybe we're going into this direction with the Elite. But what did you get? What did you get from what happened on Dynamite and where Hangman is actually going?
I feel like it's not really a step forward. I think you do that program with Moxley, you do that, you know, Hangman comes out as a winner. You're right. You know, I forgot to mention his name, but Hangman's another guy I mentioned that probably should be next in line for MJF, right? Coming off his feud with Moxie, he beat a multiple shine champion, right? But now he's going to go. Now we're going back into this, a lot of this, you know, CW teen drama stuff with Hangman and Elite and more matches. I can see Tony Khan thinking, like, well, it's going to be different because now we got Claudio and Yuta and Elite guys and maybe a fourth guy for Blackpool Comic Club. I don't think it's going to be Brian, maybe a new member. And that will be different. Obviously, I think he's also building towards his blood and guts match. Probably this is going to be the match, right? And I don't know. I think it's time to move on for Hangman as well. I think he didn't really gain much out of it, out of beating. If he would have got the title shot next, or these upper, you know, going towards that way, yeah, it would be beneficial. But here, it's just the same old stuff. I don't know. And what they're going to do? What's when Hangman and Mox going to do now in rematches, right?
Yeah,
I mean, but it's different because Kenny Omega's there with them in the Bucks.
Well, you know, what comes after Texas Death?
Death.
Hell in a Cell.
Oh,
that's where they got to go.
Well, they're going to go blood and guts, I guess.
Yeah, true. That is where they go, I guess.
Reverse Battle Royal. That's what they're going to do.
Okay, so you and I have been watching Dynamite since day one.
Mm-hmm.
We've watched every show. I think I've missed two because of being on vacation that I didn't actually catch up on. I think we mentioned that. I think there was one last fall that I didn't watch. I think that was the first show from that they did from Canada. I think it was a Toronto show. So, okay, 99% of these shows we've watched and, you know, watch with a magnifying glass. There was a segment on Wednesday that I actually fast-forwarded through because I was so appalled at what was going on.
The girls?
Powerhouse Hobbs.
Oh, the TMZ, yes. Horrible.
Finally, gets his belt. QT is involved. And the follow-up is this goofy TMZ-style magazine thing. And I was so appalled that this is what Will is doing.
Will wins the title, even though there's major issues with the way he won the title. The following week, the follow-up is a segment that highlights QT Marshall and his new lame gimmick, QT TV, a spoof on TMZ. And you have poor Power Hobbs just sitting there with the belt in his hand. Just a what a waste. It's bad. But will it improve? I don't think so. This is bad. Where was this thing filmed at? Some dark office that they. It was horrible. The lighting was horrible. The content was horrible. QT just has go away heat, you know, as a performer on that show. He's meant nothing for like a year and a half or whatever, you know. Even when he was feuding with Cody, we were tired of it after a few weeks of it, right?
Yeah,
because he's not a main event guy, he's just bringing down Will Hobbs. I'm telling you.
And I don't like to just, you know, these guys are, this is their livelihood, so. You know, when we critique, I want to be fair in the critique and not just pile on. And the thing that I wish we got out of the QT thing, and someone may say, oh, yeah, you know, they were doing something similar on Dark and Elevate. No one's seeing that stuff, so it really doesn't count. I wish we had some segments where QT had separated himself from his crew. And tried to be a babyface so that his heel turn against Wardlow actually meant something and that we got to know him for a little while, because from what it looks like, at least to me, he's a random character who shows up on Dynamite once a month, loses every single time, not someone to be taken seriously, and now he's with one of their top guys, and I have no idea why. I don't know why we should care about this dude, because we have never had to care about him before in this role. I just wish there was a little bit of character development so that his turn would have meant something. And then when he does become this dastardly heel, we don't look at him as, why is the job guy the manager of the champion?
Yep, exactly. Same thing with, all of a sudden, Mark Sterling shows up next to Jade in her segment, right? I haven't seen them together in a very long time. On the same show, he again, Jade is over, you know? She doesn't need Mark Sterling. She could talk for herself. He brings her down, you know? Mark's a good guy. I'm not knocking their character as a person. Same with the QT. But just, they're so cold as characters on the show. Their wrestling personas are cold. No one cares because as you said it, the bookies never made us care about these guys.
All right, last segment that I want to talk about, and if you have anything else to bring up, let me know, was the main event. The John LaRocca Invitational this week was the trios title three-way with the House of Black against the Blackpool Combat Club against the Elite. You know what's funny about this? Is because of the way this match was booked, the actual champions were not the story. Yeah, because they're in Canada. They're an afterthought. They're in Canada. It's Omega. It's Jericho. The fans are super excited. They created a match out of this match that people want to see, which is Omega and Jericho. They haven't had a match against each other in quite a long time. So there was like, oh, these fans really, really want to see this. That's awesome. And, Sammy and Garcia, I would love to see them mix it up with the Young Bucks. I think that'll be a really fun match. But you know who was just kind of there, even though they won the match, was House of Black. So I almost wish that they took the Trios champs out of this match, and it should have just been a tag with those teams. I think the match would have been just as good. Or better, and we'll get your thoughts on the quality of it. But I saw the crowd being super fired up. They loved it. They loved when their guys were facing off. I thought Jericho and Omega did a great job at teasing and teasing, and then they didn't get to it, and then they finally got to it, and the crowd is in the palm of their hands. And ultimately, I liked it because of that. I thought, you know, the fans made the match. The match was good. I liked the way it went off. You know, take it or leave it with the Hangman thing and Moxley. They kind of shoehorned that in at the end with the picture in picture of Moxley's team still fighting with the Dark Order and Hangman. But ultimately, I thought it was a good piece of business, and it created a future matchup. But at the same time, I was like, man, I really wish the House of Black did something else in that match, because I thought they were the ones who didn't need to be there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a bad booking to already just do this match right away, right? There's no need for the House of Black, the champions. They just won the titles. It's okay for two teams to fight, you know, wrestle each other for a title shot. And then, I wasn't a fan of the match itself. You know, there's some cool moments. I thought when Jericho and Omega, you know, of course they teased it. People were into that. But then when they finally came together, Jericho was doing a great job of really trying to milk the moment. But Kenny Omega doesn't understand the moment. And he rushed in to start throwing these whack-ass punches and said, dude, take your time. Let it breathe. Circle around each other. Look, you know, think like true pros. Think Hulk Hogan, think The Rock, WrestleMania, right? When they just would just look, you know, I don't know if they would have got that big a reaction, but they're beloved wrestlers from Winnipeg. I think they would have milked that. It would have felt bigger. It would have felt bigger if they would have milked it better. And that was on Meg because he's right rushed it. But and the whole thing with the Moxley and the like and the Dark Order. So it was so stupid because you didn't tell us or show us any more fighting since the earlier in the night with these guys after the match. You didn't show they're still going at it. And there's a clip of them fighting and people breaking them up. And they're still out of here again, you know, and like we're trying to sell these guys down locker room. It's chaos here. And then they could come out, you know, and do their deal. Then it kind of make a little more sense. But also it was like, just, oh, let's go on the back.
Yeah. It's almost like we missed a piece of the segment of something of showing them still fighting. Like what they should have showed it like one more time. Okay. I'm going to give Omega a little bit of the benefit of the doubt here about what you're saying. A lot of times when it comes to this main event segment, they are rushed for time and
they had a lot of time.
They almost didn't have enough time when the show cut out, because we didn't even see Hangman's reaction. They went off the air like a second early, right? When he's supposed to see who's behind him. So my thought on that is, if Omega, you know, knew, like, I don't think he doesn't understand the moment. Like he wrestled the master of the moment in Kazuchika Okada, and that stuff was perfect when it came to that. So I think he gets it, and I think he would have done it, but I think they were like a little rushed for time, like they always are in their main events. And so that's my thought on that part of it.
It went two segs, like in had two segs, and you know what? There's no need to rush that moment for a time. Let, you know, cut some shit out that it, you know, they don't need to, you know, do every little thing they had planned, you know. Oh, I just died laughing when the Bucks were setting up the Meltzer driver and Nick Jackson tells Aubrey to tell, I think he wanted to tell Jericho to cut him off, you know, but she goes to Buddy Murphy, who just shakes his head like, no, it's not me. And then Nick's like moves over to the side even more and goes, Jericho. And then she goes, tells Jericho, and then he cuts her off. That was pretty funny.
I guess my question is, you know, let's say that Omega just on the fly goes, okay, we're going to take 30 more seconds here. And so then you got to figure out, okay, we got to take 30 seconds out of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, who calls that shot? Like, who's the one? Like, how do you, when you have nine guys,
Jericho,
who decides, you know, who's
Tony Khan,
but
producer of the match,
but he's in the referee's ear. So then she's got to communicate to these guys who are going 1,000 miles a minute and getting all their stuff in. I just think it's probably a little bit more chaotic in not only in that kind of match, but also in the AEW style, which is a very high spot style.
I mean, it happens all the time, and NXT stuff gets cut off. Come says, hey, we got to go. We got to, you know, get, you know, screw this, screw that, do this. I mean, I've heard it many times. So,
but aren't they like they're taught that, right? Like that is something. And I don't, does AEW, you know, do they have that? Does Tony go, hey, guys, you know, in this situation, and I make a call, like, here's what we do. Like, I just know that, you know, in NXT, WWE has a specific style. They have their own style, you know, where they make that call and the people know what to do because they're like, okay, like, this is we're just going right to the finish or whatever. So I just wonder if, you know, if it's different with AEW in that sense.
It shouldn't be different because you want to hit the important beats, right? You want to hit the moments that you really want people to stay with. Jericho, Omega facing off in that crowd with that, you know, with their hometown crowd. You want that moment. At the end, you want, you know, the tease of is Elite backing up Hangman Page or are they just confronting the Blackpool Combat Club? And if you feel there's, I mean, he should know, I would think, I mean, I did on the small level. I knew the main event spots. I knew everything that was going on towards the finish because I wanted to know when it was going to end, what they had going on. And of course, I had my ideas for, you know, things they wanted to do. But he should have some kind of idea of like what they still had planned to go. And if he was looking at his time and worried that they're not going to hit that very important cliffhanger they wanted to leave the audience on their television show, he needed made a call to the referee to, hey, speak, cut some things out, get to the finish sooner because we're going to be running out of time and we're going to go out there before we do the big tease. So it's just, I mean, that's what he has to, that's just wrestling television, live wrestling television, right? So he has to, or the producer who's on it. I don't know. I mean, it's not just Tony himself, I mean, it's the producer too. I don't know how he specifically does it, but I would think a producer and him are on the headset talking to the referee.
All right. Was there any other big picture stuff you wanted to talk about that show?
Not really. Taya Valkyrie debuted. I thought I wasn't really too excited how they did it. I'm just glad she didn't debut and lose.
And
you
lose,
know?
Yeah.
So they had, you know, Nicole Matthews, who just, you know, didn't look good at all, you know, just not, I don't know. She just, it just like, who's this, you know, like, I know who she is, but like, it was like, at first it was a disappointment and you're like, oh, great. That's who it is. And, you know, and Taya comes out, she got a good reaction. She's from Canada. They know her. And I think it's a good thing that she went to AEW. I didn't think she was ever going to go back to WWE because just what happened last time. And, you know, she was really affected by that. It really hurt her.
Was that Taya? I thought that was Frankie Monet.
yeah. And I, you know, that's going to be a very big challenge. Her as Jay's a very big challenge. You kind of have to keep it short, keep a high impact. You know, Frankie, great personality. I love her look. But she also needs, she's been wrestling a long time, but she also needs someone in there, you know, to keep it all together. So it's going to be a challenge, but I think if they keep it short, it'll be fine.
All right. Let's throw it to the segment that I did with Robert Silva talking Creed 3, Creed 3 Universe. And then John and I will come back to wrap up this show. If you've been a fan of this podcast for a long time, you will have heard this voice on many occasions, but he hasn't been on this show in a little while now. But Robert Silva, what is going on?
What's up, Garrett? What's up, Fight Game family?
So
I was thinking about how am I going to review Creed 3? Now, you remember this, but a lot of people probably don't because it was so long ago. My buddy Doan and I, we did a long series in this feed, but before we came on F4W Wrestling Observer, where we broke down all of the Rocky movies and all of the Creed movies. And when Creed 2 was over, we did the epilogue and we're like, oh, maybe they'll make a Creed 3. They probably will. But I can't get Doan to come back on with me. Maybe I'm still working on him to do that like full Creed 3 episode the way that we did those other episodes.
Look,
but
you got to get Doan because, ladies and gentlemen, those eight episodes that they did, the six Rocky movies and the first two Creed movies, you're not getting a better overview, historical overview of each movie. They brought out the facts, the whole nine. This is, man, you can't get better coverage of the Rocky series, the Rocky franchise, than what Garrett and Doan did. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was a lot of work, but I think it was because we enjoyed digging in and we wanted to learn some things ourselves, right? So it was a lot of fun. And if we're gonna do it again, you know, we'll do it in the same way. We won't shint on. I just gotta get Doan to
Doan,
agree
Doan.
To do it.
You listen to Doan because you always listen because you listen to my a box of podcasts every week. Get with our boy. Let's get this done. No, let's get you and Garrett back in the lab.
It'll be a blast. I'm hoping that we can do it. Okay, but. Yeah. You know, this what we're going to do here today is have a little bit more of a sort of an instant reaction to the movie Creed 3 came out. What would have been the first time you saw the original Rocky? Do you even remember?
It would have been on CBS TV, Channel 2 in New York, WCBS, 1977. Back in the day, Garrett, you were born in 75, 76?
76,
you,
yes.
You
76.
Were born in 76. All right, back in the day, Garrett, you might have remembered from the early 80s, but in the late 70s, networks like ABC, CBS, NBC, the three networks, because back then you only had ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, and syndicated UHF stations, right?
Yeah.
So when a blockbuster movie came out, like a Rocky, like a Star Wars, like, what was that? Close Encounters of the Third Kind, mm-hmm. Godfather, whatever. The three networks would bid with the major motion picture studios. And the highest bidder would get the rights to the movie.
Right.
For I don't know how many years. They would pay big bucks for it. So CBS, and I'm not sure who owned CBS at the time. There was no such thing. Ooh, there was a Viacom. Ladies and gentlemen, Viacom. You know how Viacom started? Garrett, you probably know. Viacom was the leading syndication owner of shows like I Love Lucy.
Oh, wow.
Father's Knows Best, My Three Sons. That's how Viacom got into the game from the 1950s on. But when they bought stake in VH1, I think, in the early 80s, and mm-hmm. then MTV, and then they were able in the 90s to purchase CBS and the rest of the Viacom family. You know, the entire Viacom family.
Right.
But I think Westinghouse, was it Westinghouse? I forgot who owned CBS back in the 1970s. But they outbid ABC and NBC. So the first time, Garrett, I saw Rocky, the original Rocky, was, I believe, the fall of 1977. Because the original Rocky came out in 76.
Right.
The fall of 77, it was on either a Sunday or Monday night. Because the biggest nights in television back in the 1970s and 1980s, before NBC exploded with their Thursday night lineup in 1984, was always Sunday and Monday nights. And that's when you had blockbuster shows like All in the Family, later, Mary Tyler Moore. Those shows would come on Sunday, and then Monday Night Football. Those were 60 Minutes on Sunday. Sunday and Mondays were the biggest ratings nights, for network television. Today, it's probably Sunday and Thursday. Monday, they let if it's not Monday Night Football, network television's trash.
Yeah.
Through the rest of the year. But back in the 70s and 80s, it was Sunday and Monday. So I believe it was either a Sunday night or Monday night that I watched it with my parents, the original Rocky.
Oh, wow. So I would have been several years later that I would have remembered. Honestly, the first Rocky that is really vivid in my mind is Rocky III, because that came out when I was like six.
Yeah, that came out in 82, right?
Yeah, so the reason why I ask you that is because now here we are in 2023, and the extension of the Rocky universe is in Creed. And I think, you know, I don't know how you rank these films, but I recently rewatched Creed 1 and Creed 2. Creed 1 is tremendous. Creed 2, they needed an editor for that one, but they were trying to tell a specific story.
And, you know what's funny? Cool. You know what's funny, Garrett? It's sort of similar to Rocky 1 being this masterpiece, because I consider Creed 1 a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And then Rocky 2, like Creed 2,
really long,
was solid, but because the first one was so great, people came out of the movies thinking, man, that wasn't as good as the first one. It's hard to duplicate.
Yeah, totally, totally.
It's hard. It's hard.
But the bounce bounce back for Rocky was Rocky 3. They took it in a little bit of a different way.
Just like Creed 3. Yes.
And so did Creed 3. So I think that worked to their advantage, and it's following a similar blueprint. And as of this recording, Creed 3, heading into their third week, has already grossed more money than the original Creed and will probably surpass the second one, I would assume, very soon. So great job for Ryan Coogler, Michael B. Jordan, Erwin Winkler, his brother, MGM. So good stuff for them. And we're gonna. I want to ask you some questions about Creed 3. Now, we're not going to go down, you know, bit by bit and storyline by storyline, but I do have some thoughts, and I kind of want to get your thoughts on this too. So, obviously, the elephant in the room in this movie is there's no Rocky. Like, it is based off of the Rocky character and the characters Sylvester Stallone created, but he is not in this film, and he is pretty angry about it. Not the fact that he's not in the movie as much as why he decided to not be a part of this franchise anymore. And it has to do with Erwin Winkler. Originally, Sly kind of sold off the rights to these characters early in the process of the movies. And so now he wants them back, and it doesn't look like that's going to happen. So he's been very upset about it. And he's kind of, I don't know if he's trashing the movie, but he's saying that, you know, he's not going to watch it. He doesn't like the way that they took the hero character down this really dark path, which is really why the character still works. But to Rocky, like, this hero shouldn't be, you know, in this dark, going down this dark road. I don't know. I just find his comments to be...
That's bitterness.
Okay. A little old man, you know, kind of screaming at young kids kind of mentality.
And you know what? He's the one who picked Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler to begin with. Remember, I think you guys might have covered it in the Rocky series. He saw Fruitvale Station and was like, this is the guy. This is the guy where I could resurrect the franchise. It was all because of what Stallone felt. And I understand his bitterness, but I think Stallone should have put his ego aside. Did they want him in this movie or not? I'm not sure about that, Gary. Do you know if they wanted him to be in Creed 3?
Okay, so the only thing that, if you watch Creed 2, there is a moment after Adonis beats Victor Drago where he's kind of motioning Rocky to come into the ring with him, and Rocky actually walks backwards. And he sits down in a chair and he points at Adonis Creed and he says, it's your time now. So my guess is that Stallone knew that the future of where this story was going was not going to include him. And, you know, so it seems like it was very much the storyline direction to have him not included. But at the same time, I would have been fine with Adonis getting on the phone, you know, with Rocky going like, hey, when you retired, how hard was it for you? Or just like a small scene in there, because that is a big part of this film, which is how Adonis deals with the emotion and not being able to resolve all of his problems in the gym. And that would have been a nice little callback to Rocky just giving him a phone call and asking him for advice. So that could have been in there, but the fact that it's not in there, I don't really, it didn't feel like it was missing.
There was, We did not miss Stallone in this movie at all.
No. Not at all.
And I have to give huge kudos to Wood Harris, because he was wasted in the first two Creed movies because he barely got any lines.
Yes.
In my opinion, Garrett, Wood Harris was the greatest portrayal of a boxing trainer I've ever seen in any boxing movie. And then I know people are going to say, well, what about Mickey? To me, Mickey was a caricature of that old trainer. Oh, you got to get in there, right? You know, that old trainer. While Wood Harris looks like the trainers of today, the trainers like Derek James, trainers like that. Wood Harris, and like he does with every one of his roles, really bought into this, and he was phenomenal in this movie. And I'm glad that one of the positives that came out of Stallone no longer being around was, you know, if he's Creed's trainer, Wood Harris is going to be a second banana like in 1 and 2. This one, he's the main trainer, and the scenes that he has with both Damian and Adonis were tremendous because Wood Harris is tremendous.
Yes. Yes. He's great, and he's finally getting, you know, some kudos on the big screen where he was, you know, he's always been fantastic on the small screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that he is in this for sure. So here's my main problem with Creed and the Creed universe. And we'll come back to the Creed universe at the end of mm-hmm. this show, because it does look like there is a future in making maybe not only a Creed 4, but possibly also other projects coming from this group of mm-hmm. actors and actresses and characters. The timeline in Creed is off. And there's an article on Screen Rant that does a really good job of explaining it. But I'm watching this movie, and I saw it two times because I wanted to, you know, to make sure that, you know, in talking about it, I wanted to kind of have, you know, I was looking for certain things the second mm-hmm. time just to make sure, you know, I was remembering correctly. So the original Creed comes out in 2015. So that is sort of the time frame of when Adonis Creed meets Rocky. If we go by the original timeline of Rocky, Adonis Creed is probably born in 85,
he's supposed
86.
To be 85 because 85 is when Apollo died, and
yes.
You could correct me if I'm mistaken. Adonis was supposed to be like 6 months old when Apollo died, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he would have to have been 30 years old in 2015.
Right. Okay. So 2015. So let's fast forward to 2023. He would be around 38-ish.
Yeah. 37 if you want to say that they might have been looking for a 2022 release.
Right. Okay. So except I don't think that is his actual age in the movie. And here's why.
But before you go that, Damian, played by Jonathan Majors.
Yes.
He was in prison 17, 18 years. What was the amount of time he in prison? It was a good amount.
Yeah, so 2002 is where this movie begins.
Right.
And I think we're supposed to think that Adonis in 2002...
They look 15, 16.
Yeah, he looks about 15, but if by the Rocky math, he should probably be about 17.
Yes.
So that's not off.
I think Jonathan Majors is definitely... His character was the older character.
Right.
Because he was so much bigger.
Yes.
As kids.
Yes. So he was probably at least 2 or 3 years older.
So I'm thinking... And he won the Golden Gloves and the whole nine. So I'm thinking Jonathan Majors' timeline is right. Adonis is a couple of years off.
So now, mm-hmm. if we go back to 2002, then we fast forward, the screen jumps to 2017. And this is where Adonis is fighting Pretty Ricky Conlan for the second time to unify the championships. But if they first fought... in the first movie in 2015,
right,
and then he fights Victor Drago in 2018 in Creed 2. We are jumping back a year.
Backwards. I didn't. I didn't notice that. You're right. I didn't notice that.
So that is where the first big, like, whoops. Like, so they haven't talked about this. Maybe Michael B. Jordan will talk about this. And, you know, maybe the, my thought is maybe Creed 1 happens a little bit closer to after Rocky Balboa, which was 2006, than we realized. Right. Maybe they just didn't set that stage correctly.
But
maybe
did they ever give you a date in any of these movies?
No, not until this one, I think.
Right. Not until this one they did. I'm talking about the first two. Because what did they say his age was when he came out of, when he was boxing and working in a corporate firm?
Right. But still living with moms, right? He's still living with moms as far as what we understood.
Yeah, yeah. He was until he became heavyweight champion of the world, he was living with moms.
Okay, so then now we'll just quickly give the rest of the timeline.
And there's another problem I got with this though. There's one huge problem I got with the Creed movies.
Okay.
When he fought Pretty Ricky Collin, they were light heavyweights.
Yes.
Second movie, all of a sudden he's a heavyweight. Michael B. Jordan is what, 5'10"? He's not a heavyweight. All right, they should have stuck to light heavyweight.
But it gets worse in this movie. And we're going to talk about this in a second. Okay, so then after he beats Pretty Ricky Conlon to unify the belts, then he retires. And we fast forward to 2020. It says 3 years later is 2020. And this is when he gets his Oscar De La Hoya on. He's the promoter of his fights such. So that the fact that it's 2020, I think it really kind of shortens this window of when all of these fights could have happened. And I don't know. I think that's maybe they're just like, hey, we'll let you guys do the math. You know, this works for us.
But if you look at 20, if they base it at 2020, 18 years is what Jonathan Majors' character Damien was in prison for.
Right.
And it would add the timeline would match him getting arrested and convicted in 2002.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that's why they did it. That's exactly why they did it. Okay.
And it would make Adonis 35, maybe, or between 33 and 35.
Yeah. So they're shaving some years off of Adonis to make his Oscar De La Hoya transition to work in, you know, and instead of him coming back at like 42, and then that would make Jonathan Majors like 45. Like, they're like, no, we'll just shave some years off to make this make a little bit more sense.
I think at 45, Michael B. Jordan will still look like he's 30.
Probably. He probably will. Okay, so what did you think of Michael B. Jordan, of Adonis Creed's transition into sort of the Oscar De La Hoya role? Did you find it to be realistic?
I found it to be very realistic because Floyd has done it. Oscar was the first to do it. Bernard Hopkins. That's the trend. A trend that I always wanted, even as a kid. My father used to say, these guys need to be their own promoters. And Oscar was the first. Oscar followed by Bernard, who hooked up with Oscar, Floyd. There's a lot of money to be made in promoting boxing. And think about this, Garrett. I've always said this. I would trust an ex-boxer, an all-time great fighter, over a sleazy promoter like a Bob Arum or a Don King or Eddie Hearn.
Yeah.
So this was very realistic, and he played the role. He played the role perfectly.
Okay, great. Because I thought the same thing, and I liked also there's a small nod to Oscar promoting his friends Hopkins and Mosley.
Right. And Mosley, right.
As Adonis Creed promotes Victor Drago.
And what I love about the entire 9 movies in the Rocky franchise is that they always take from what's going on in boxing or what went on in boxing.
Right, exactly. Okay, so I just wanted to point this out because I thought the music in this movie was very interesting. It is a very heavily J. Cole, Dreamville.
Because they did the soundtrack.
They did the soundtrack, so it's heavy on that. But the opening scene I thought was so perfect when it came to music choice, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this. So first time I saw this movie, the movie opens where they go back to 2002. And Adonis and Dame, they go to like a Golden Gloves match, and Dame is actually fighting. Mm-hmm. And so it's very LA, right? It's very West Coast. And so this beat starts playing. And I'm like, oh, where are they going with this? And right before Dr. Dre's voice comes on, I go, "The Watcher." And he says, "The Watcher," Watcher. Right at the same time.
It was perfect. It was perfect.
So great. Now, if you've heard Chronic 2001, mm-hmm. or just, I think it's just called 2001, like that song. And then Jay-Z and Dr. Dre would do The Watcher Part 2 with Rakim, mm-hmm. which is probably a better version than Dre's version.
It's a better version, but you want the original version,
yes.
because it fits L.A.
It fits L.A.
That version is more East Coast.
Yes, yeah. exactly. So they then, in the training sequence, use the stem of The Watcher, and then J. Cole comes in and does mm-hmm. a version of that song as well, which I thought was a nice touch. And I think they straddled sort of the old school West Coast hip hop from that time frame, 2002. That's a perfect song for 2002.
It's also a great callback to what happened when they were kids.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So we agree on that. I thought that was a great music choice. And overall, you know, I was asking, you know, people who are younger than me, because this is more the soundtrack for them than it is for me with J. Cole being involved. And, you know, I think they just were like, yeah, that's kind of what it should have been in 2023. So good job, Michael B. Jordan and Coogler. You guys have good friends and you have good partnerships.
And also, they're young guys. They're compared to us, they're young. Ryan and Michael B. Jordan, young guys. So they'd be more hip to using artists like a J. Cole, Dreamville. Or in the past, when they used Meek Mill.
Yes, exactly. Because that was Philly.
Yep. It only makes sense. Right, yeah.
All right, so we have these new characters, and we mentioned Jonathan Majors, who is blowing up like nobody's.
He's the hottest star in Hollywood right now.
He's an Ant-Man.
He's hotter than Michael B. Jordan, which is hard to do. Cause...
Now, okay, so we have this idea in hip-hop sometimes when there is a... Mm-hmm. You have and you know, people, I'll just give an example from what I can think about, which is Renegade, Jay-Z and Eminem. And it's Jay-Z's album and Eminem comes on and everyone goes, "Oh, man, Eminem just stole the song on Jay-Z's
album." Oh, he was phenomenal. That's the best song he ever did, in my opinion.
Okay, so now my question is, does Jonathan Majors kind of take this movie from Michael B. Jordan? He's the most compelling... Maybe you know, now
every movie Jonathan Majors has ever been in, he is the most compelling actor in the movie, the most compelling character. You're from the Bay. Did you ever see The Last Black Man in San Francisco?
No.
You got to see that movie. First of all, you will love it. You're from the Bay Area. It's about gentrification in black neighborhoods and how black residents are being pushed out, just like it all over the country. All right, And you've got Danny Glover and Jonathan Majors.
Oh,
and
no way.
Yeah, you got to see the movie. I believe it's on Showtime.
I've heard of this movie
before, 2017, definitely. It was the first time, it was the first major role for Jonathan Majors. He had been a theater actor for years, struggling to make it in the movies. And this was the one that got his foot in the door. Now, when he really exploded was Lovecraft Country, which he was fucking phenomenal on HBO, which is streaming on HBO Max. I'd recommend the listeners, if you haven't watched The Last Black Man in San Francisco or Lovecraft Country, you will see why Jonathan Majors is who he is. He's a phenomenal actor. He could do it all. He could do drama, and we've seen him in action. What did he play? I haven't seen the movie yet. Kang? I heard he was phenomenal as Kang.
That movie is not getting the greatest reviews from the Marvel Universe. His mm-hmm. character is a big part of what's upcoming, and mm-hmm. he's awesome. Like, he's perfect for the role, but... I think if the movie was a little bit better, he would even get more press out of this.
He reminds me physically with his aura and his presence of a young Idris Elba, where he gets on the screen and he doesn't have to say anything and he eats up the screen. And that's what happened when Idris was first on The Wire.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I want to see more of this guy.
Yes. Then, yeah, absolutely.
And you know what? Michael B. Jordan doesn't have any ego, if you've noticed throughout his entire career. He never calls himself the best. He plays the roles and he does his best. And even he agrees. Jonathan Majors is that dude.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, they could have given Majors more to do, but because he is so great and he's so compelling, the Dame Anderson, the Dame character may have even overshadowed Adonis
yes.
Creed, and
yes,
so
yes.
they couldn't give him even more than he got. Okay, there's another boxer in this movie, and I want to get your thoughts on this because it kind of frustrated me. Now, no one else probably cares except for us, but Felix Chavez is the heavyweight champion after Adonis Creed retires, and
does he weigh more than 160 pounds?
Okay, this is what we're getting. He is Michael B. Jordan's guy, right? This is Oscar's Canelo in this scene or in this movie.
Right.
And so, you know, he can't keep the sparring partners because he's waxing all these guys. And so he is played by a real boxer, Jose Benavides Jr. Now, that is also a theme to this series in that.
Doesn't make any sense. Jose Benavides Jr. has never fought past 154 pounds.
Okay, we're going to get there. But in Creed 1, there were two real boxers in Creed 1. Tony Bellew was the heel. Mm-hmm. And who's
Andre
the
kid? Ward. Andre Ward was in the first one, too.
Well, okay, then there's a third one. Who's the young kid?
Gabriel Zotto. He
yes,
fights next week.
Yes, yeah, yes, yeah. yes. So he's
well,
also
they had
in
him
movie.
In the movie because he's a Philly fighter.
Right, and there was also a callback to his name in Creed 3 as a possible contender for Felix Chavez. Mm-hmm. Okay, like you said, he is a 160-pound, and we're pushing it at a 160-pound fighter. Mm-hmm. And they are showing him as a heavyweight. Now, his two biggest fights were against Terrence Crawford and Danny Garcia. He lost both of them.
Which one was at 147? One was at 140.
Yeah. And so I think this is the realism flaw of this movie.
I think
Benavides Jr. as the champion.
I think I know why they did it, though. I've just thought of this. They have to make Jonathan Majors look like a beast, right?
Yes.
He already towers over Michael B. Jordan.
Yes.
So they got to get somebody else around Michael B. Jordan's height so Jonathan Majors could just overwhelmingly look much bigger. Because Jonathan Majors is what? You can look it up real quick. 6'1", 6'2"?
Yeah, I'll look it up.
Yeah, now, I think he's 6'1", 6'2". So you got to match him up with guys shorter than him.
Now, some will say that I am being hypocritical. Because Sylvester Stallone himself,
5'8",
and probably pushing it at his heaviest when he's the most jacked at about 175 pounds, probably.
I think he's more than that. When he's jacked to the gills, I think he's maybe 200.
You think so? You think he can get up to 200?
I think when he was jacked to the gills, and then, if I'm not mistaken, I think back in 82 when he was jacked for Rocky III, I think. I'm reading an old Ring magazine from when I was 14 years old that they mentioned Stallone was now weighing 195 pounds, which I wouldn't be surprised. He was jacked. He was completely jacked.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that is also you can get away with that if you go back to the Rocky movies because Stallone himself was a small person. And that's why, you know, because Mr. T, not a giant man in real life, like a big guy, but not a giant man. But in with Stallone, he looks like a giant human. And
Mr. T, maybe 5'10", 5'11"?
Yes. Okay, so then the actress who plays his mother, people will probably remember Laura Chavez from Orange is the New Black on Netflix.
Tremendous actress. Actress, yes.
So Michael B. Jordan is a giant anime fan. Now, I am not a giant anime fan, but I have a couple of kids who watched anime in the past.
My son was an anime fan his entire life, and my nephew's an anime fan. Yeah.
And when I told my oldest, because that's who I saw the show with the movie with the second time, and I said, hey, look for some Dragon Ball influences because Michael B. Jordan said that a lot of one specific punch was very Dragon Ball influenced. And I asked him and he said that he thought all of the fight scenes were pretty anime influenced when it came to the slow motion and how he used the setups for a lot of the big punches. So I'm not an expert on that, but I just wanted to point that out because Michael B. Jordan himself is a giant anime fan. So there's an anime influence to this. So ultimately, what did you think of the portrayal of boxing? Now that you know that there were, it was big punches. It was a high spot boxing match for all the fights. But overall, like, what were your thoughts on it?
The boxing, the boxing scenes were the best I've ever seen.
That's awesome.
I mean, they were tremendous. And I originally had a problem with them using the DAZN announcing crew because I hate them. But then when Chris Mannix, like in real life, on screen, put his foot in his mouth.
Yes.
Oh, I don't know if Adonis Creed, I don't know if he could have something to the line where I don't know if he can. The guy's had one pro fight. This is a former heavyweight champion of the world. What are you talking? It's the same type of nonsense he talks about in real life. So kudos to Ryan Coogler's brother, because he must be a boxing fan, because he had this guy.
Todd Gresham and Chris Mannix. I guess there was a visual of Mannix's podcast with Sergio Mora on one of the TVs, so at least Sergio Mora got in there a little bit. Yeah. They should have had Sergio Mora play. Felix Chavez.
He would have been better,
right?
Yes. Wasn't Canelo supposed to be in the movie? Did I miss him?
No, he was in. He was in the movie during the Showtime.
Oh, yes.
He and his, is that his wife?
Yeah, that's his wife in real life. Yes.
He did very well.
He's Canelo. If he doesn't do well, then there's something wrong. Right?
And so there was also a Showtime boxing event where you got to hear Mauro Ranallo's voice and a little bit of Al Bernstein, like just a tiny itty bitty piece of Al Bernstein.
I wanted more Al and less Mauro. But yeah, you know, once again, the Rocky franchise always does this, because they in the past they used Max Kellerman and Jim Lampley and Roy Jones.
Yes.
So they always the very first Rocky, the legendary Jimmy Lennon Sr. was the ring announcer.
Yep.
Not Junior, Sr. So the Rocky franchise has always made sure to use what was being used in boxing at that time period.
So one of the fights was held in Staples, and that was the Showtime event. That's where Dame beats Felix Chavez. And then the bigger fight where it's
T-Mobile Arena, right?
No.
Vegas, right?
No.
No, it's in L.A.
Dodger Stadium.
That's right, because it's the Battle of L.A. No, was it Dodger Stadium or was it where the Chargers play?
It was Dodger Stadium.
Okay, Dodger Stadium.
Which was interesting, because I wonder...
I thought they were going to use the Chargers Stadium, being it's the new stadium, and that's where they've held fights. The last time they held a fight at Dodger Stadium was 60 years ago.
Yeah, and what was interesting is they had actors in like the first several areas of the seats, but I wondered if the rest of that thing was CGI'd, because I don't think they were going to be able to bring that many people, because that thing was packed to the gills. So that there was some good CGI.
About 25 years ago, give or take a couple of years, Kevin Costner did a baseball movie. You remember the name of that movie?
How many different baseball movies?
Oh, this is years past Field of Dreams. This was years past.
Yeah, it was the love of the game.
They offered a friend of mine offered me and my son at the time. My son at the time was six and eight years old, to go to Yankee Stadium where they filmed scenes of the movie.
Yeah.
And we couldn't go because I had to work that day, so we didn't go. But the picture in the New York Post the next day showed the entire stadium was packed. You could pack a stadium. It's free tickets. You get free. Hey, come to the screen. It's not like these guys are extras. You're just sitting in the stadium to watch scenes of a movie.
But the way that they usually do this is they actually go to an event that is actually happening. And then they go, okay, guys, we're going to shoot a couple scenes from this new movie. You're going to be in the movie. Like, I recently rewatched Rocky Balboa, and then I didn't ever realize this the first 20 times I've seen that movie. But CeeLo Green is in the crowd in Rocky Balboa just hanging out. And, like, then you have this, well, you already sold the place out, so let's just film the fake fight.
I could see that. But with the Kevin Costner one, that was an actual filming where they rented Yankee Stadium.
That's interesting. I wonder. Yeah. Well, I hope maybe some information will come out about that. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's wrap up the kind of the rest of the film piece that I want to talk about. So obviously we all know how this ends. The hero.
Will you continue? We back to the. I said this was the greatest boxing scenes I ever saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
Round 11 harkens back to what Muhammad Ali said after he fought Joe Frazier in the Thrill in Manila. It hit me when I was watching this because if you remember the 11th round, you got a cage up and you see no audience. You just see Michael B. Jordan and Jonathan Majors. And it reminded me of a quote Ali said when he fought Frazier that throughout that entire fight, because it was such a life and death struggle, he didn't hear the audience. He didn't see the referee. All he saw was him and Joe Frazier. He didn't even remember Dundee and them in the corner. All he knew, all he remembered was just him and Frazier in the middle of the ring fighting. He didn't notice anything else. And when I saw that round 11 footage, that's what I thought. I was like, wow. Did Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler's brother and Ryan Coogler do research and say, yeah, let's base this on maybe that Ali quote? I'm not sure how it would look. I would have to look into it, but I love how they've.
There's two other things that also connect with what you're saying.
Yeah.
One goes back to this Kevin Costner movie that you just brought up, because in that movie, Kevin Costner is throwing a perfect game. And this is every athlete who's ever played, because of all the chaos around you, you have to be able to turn off the sound, right?
Yes,
you almost become deaf to the sound to be in those moments. So that's how Kevin Costner described it in For Love of the Game. Now,
you know, Dwight Gooden said the same thing when he pitched his no-hitter with the Yankees.
Yeah.
That all he saw was him in the batter, and the crowd wasn't in a factor, and he didn't want to he didn't even know he was throwing a no-hitter.
Okay, but there's actually another thing, because we haven't even really brought this up yet, and we will when we talk about the Creed universe. His Adonis's daughter is deaf, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he is able to channel almost an even better sense of concentration because he lives in this world with his daughter where sign language is the number one communication for them. And they do this throughout the whole movie in discussing her and in scenes around her. So he's even able to do this in his ring where concentration is even more apparent because he lives in this other world. So that's where it ties in what you're saying about Ali and, you know, the kind of the Creed universe. So I thought that was really well done. The first time I watched it, I was like, this is hokey. I don't like it. But then when I saw it the second time, I understood why they did it. So I thought it was really good, but it's different, right?
How old do you think the daughter is in the movie?
So in Creed, and then this is where we screw up the timeline again.
Right.
Creed 2 is 2018. That's when that's when the movie comes out. So even if it's 2017, whatever.
Right.
She looks to be about, because I have 13-year-old twins. Stepsons, and I have a 7-year-old stepdaughter going on 8.
Mm-hmm.
She looks to be in the middle of them, so I'm thinking 9 or 10.
I was thinking between the ages of 8 to 10. Yeah, you're right.
And then if she's born in 2017, then she's, you know, technically only like 3 years old. But again, the timeline of original Rocky IV to Rocky V was screwed up, if you remember. You remember Rocky comes home from beating Drago, gets off the plane, and his own son is like 5 years older.
Yes. Yes.
So this is.
I mean, in real life, it's 5 years older, but you're coming back. It's supposed to be the day after he beat Drago. Right?
Yes, exactly. And it's because he wanted his real son, Sage, to play the Rocky Jr. character.
Rest in peace to Sage. He died.
Rest in peace. Yes. Okay, last couple things here before we get out of here. There is an end scene with Dame and Adonis where, you know.
When you finish, I got another Ali Frazier reference to this.
Adonis's his locker room is all partying and champagne and fun. And he knows that Dame doesn't have anybody. So he goes over to the other locker room to talk to Dame and to try and squash this beef, which is really a beef based off of miscommunication, kind of one person moving on and the other person being unable to move on. Mm-hmm. And so when they get and they sit down next to each other and they have this discussion, and Adonis apologizes and Dame basically says it's not your fault. This wasn't your deal. And then Adonis tells him, yeah, it wasn't your fault either. And so they're both kind of releasing all of this pressure mm-hmm. that they both had on each other. That scene was originally not word for word dialogue, but that scene was originally in Creed 2 with Adonis and Victor Drago. They pulled that scene out of Creed 2.
Yes.
They made it as an extra, but then I could tell Michael B. Jordan's like, you know what? This still works, and we're going to use it for this film instead. So I like that he did that, because I thought the scene with Victor Drago was great too, because what Michael B. Jordan, his character in Adonis, was telling Victor Drago was like, bro, like, you are carrying some major stuff here, mm-hmm. and you are like mm-hmm. this puppet, and this is not on you. And he's basically saying the same thing to Dame in this scene, which I really liked.
And once again, it harkens back to boxing history, and it goes back to not only the Thrill of Manila, but Ali when he lost to Larry Holmes. When the Thrill of Manila ended, Joe Frazier couldn't see in either eye, and Ali could barely walk. But he went to Frazier's dressing room, because he wanted to express, first of all, being sorry for the way he talked about Frazier punching the gorilla and up
which
going
was
into
the hype of the fight.
Right,
I know people. It's interesting because that whole thing of where Ali, some people want to give him like, oh, he's only hyping the fight, and other people are like, you could have hyped the fight in a different way. And so they maybe don't give him that benefit of the doubt. But that's kind of gone back and forth as I've grown up,
yes,
about whether or not that was as harmful as it was.
Well, he went to the locker room after the fight was over, and Ali's all fucked up. He's bleeding on the insides. He's got to go to the hospital. He gets to Frazier's dressing room, and I forget whether Frazier was en route to the hospital or about to be taken to the hospital, so he couldn't see Joe Frazier. But Joe Frazier's young son, Marvis Frazier, and those who remember Marvis, he had a very uneventful pro career.
Yes.
He didn't want to box. He was forced to box by his father, Joe. Now, Marvis has been an ordained minister for many years and has led a great life since he realized what his calling was. He sat down next to Marvis, and he was like, is your father all right? And Marvis is like, I hope so. Well, you tell your father that I fought the greatest fighter that ever lived tonight, and I'm lucky that I won. He got to talk to Marvis about that. He couldn't talk to Joe because Joe, they had to take him to the hospital.
Right.
When Larry Holmes fought Muhammad Ali, remember, he gave Ali a hellacious beating.
Yeah.
Ali
that
was,
fight
in
was
his
no fun.
Ali was in his dressing room all messed up, all beaten and battered. And Larry Holmes went into Ali's dressing room and he hugged Ali and cried like a baby. Talk about, I'm always going to love you. You're my idol. You're the reason why I'm boxing. You gave me my first job in boxing as your sparring partner. He cried. And Ali was like, oh, no, you just did your job. There's nothing to be sorry about.
Right.
So I think these, and you remember with the first Rocky, when the fight is over and Rocky and Creed are hugging each other, and then Creed's like, it's not going to be no rematch.
Yeah, exactly.
So I love that in boxing. No matter what the bad blood is before the fight, the two fighters get the respect, because to get inside a boxing ring takes more cojones than a million people put together. All right. So there's a sign of respect when it's over, even if there was bad blood. And I loved how they showed that. And I wish that was a complaint I had about Creed too. The same complaint you had. I wish they would have kept that scene in, but I'm glad he brought it back for this.
Yeah.
And it works perfectly with this movie better than with Drago, because they were childhood friends.
Yes, exactly. All right. So that leads us to what just recently came out, which is that this Creed universe is actually going to be extended. Now, it looks like, I mean, this movie.
It's too much money on the floor. They got
all, already has grossed more than the original Creed and will probably gross more than the second one and just surpass it, like, you know, really quickly. That means there's going to be a Creed 4. And I was wondering what could be the storyline here. And I don't know if you caught this, but Doan and I, one of our big complaints, and again, we're going back to timeline, is that in Rocky 2, which was 1979, we see Apollo's kids. We see Apollo and Marianne's kids.
I forgot to mention that. Yes.
And so in the first Creed and the second Creed, there's no mention of Marianne's kids. And that was always, I always had a problem with that. I was always like, come on, like, we know this. Like, this, you got to at least show them or mention them. And maybe there were scenes that they shot that they just pulled out because they didn't work. But he mentions them when he's mad at his mom.
Because he said, your own two kids didn't want me.
Right. And he's telling her how Dame was like a brother to him and protected him.
More than his two siblings who wanted nothing to do with him.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he did mention them finally.
Finally.
And I wonder now, spoiler alert, you know, now that Marianne Creed has passed, I wonder if they come back. But they have to be, even if they do the funny math, if they are 7 or 8 in 79, they're in their 50s right now.
Okay, now, he was born in 85, right?
Yes.
They looked to be 7 and 8 years old.
Yes.
Maybe a year apart in 79.
Yes.
So they would have been 14, 15 when he was born. So if you do the math, and you go by 40 years, if 2025 is next week, they got to be 54. They got to be my age.
Yes, exactly. So I do wonder if there's something there that they can create to the next conflict. Because, you know, you can't de-age this guy. Like, it is now, if we are saying 2020, this dude is in his, you know, mid to late 30s and he's retired. And where do you move from there? Can he fight again? Maybe he does fight, but what's the beef?
Make Jonathan Majors. You could base the next Creed on Jonathan Majors as being the main protagonist with Michael B. Jordan as his advisor, trainer, promoter. Or you can go in the future, because I think if this continues, you're going to have a third generation Creed boxer.
Yes, I think that is where they want us to see this movie
because
going.
Things aren't done by accident. There's a reason why she was in the ring shadow boxing when the movie ended.
And then in one of the scenes, there is a woman trainer who's actually working with Adonis. In inside the ring, like, she's holding mitts for him. At first, I thought it was Michaela.
It did look like her.
I couldn't validate that she was actually.
I'd have to look at
movie.
The IMDb, but that might have been her. But you know what? Wood Harris is young enough where he could train her with Michael B. Jordan's assistant doing the sign language in between, it's a way of keeping both Michael B. Jordan and Wood Harris continuing on the legacy of Creed. If you do a third generation, they definitely going to do I don't know if it's going to be the next one, but they're definitely going to do a deaf female boxer as his daughter rising up and the pressure on her. And maybe the pressure won't be much on her because she can't hear anything.
Right. Well, it's a different pressure, right? It's a different pressure.
Yeah.
If anybody knows exactly who that trainer was in Creed 3, definitely hit me up, because I was like, she looks really.
She looked just like her.
Yeah. So.
And by the way, the young girl that played Creed's daughter strikes a bearing resemblance to one of the most popular female boxers today, Alicia Baumgartner, who's in her mid-20s. Okay.
So I'm actually glad you said that, because she's been asked, right? They've asked Alicia if she would be willing to play the daughter, and she, you know, because
she ain't going to say no.
Yeah. So it looks like the person who maybe held the mitts was a local trainer
from LA,
Patrice something or other. I don't know. I should have done that research before.
She did look like, I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
That it was Michaela Meyer.
It doesn't look like it was her. Okay, so you're in on a Creed universe though. Could they do if the daughter Amara is the next Creed 4 and it is her, could you see a TV series getting us from Creed 3 to Creed 4?
I talked about this a few years ago when I told you about what I loved about you and Duan's series and how I would love to see a Netflix series.
Yes.
On Wood Harris playing Tony's son, Little Duke. I would love, and Wood Harris is one of the best TV actors out there. He would kill that, where you would have an 8-10-part series of him training fighters, getting young kids out of the hood, getting them out of stealing drugs or whatever. I think that would be incredible.
So there's another story, and this is one that Stallone got really mad on, which is continuing the Drago story in another movie with...
That's been talked about for years, right?
With Dolph Lundgren back as the character.
And the guy who plays the son, right?
And taking that in a different direction away from these other characters. And that's very interesting. But there's also another one that has been rumored, which actually does involve Stallone. And this idea has him taking on some kids who may not have their papers and be in this country legally, and use these kids as a way to bring the Rocky character back, because he is actually, you know, trying to help them. So I've heard those stories. I like your idea with Wood Harris. I just think you can do multiple things with this franchise now that Michael B. Jordan has shown maybe that was the strategy overall.
Can we move away
from Stallone and have it still be successful?
They already proved it. Am I mistaken? Was there ever talk about a prequel to Rocky, Young Rocky?
I've not heard that. But
I would love that too.
You know what the problem is? Who plays Burgess Meredith? Because who plays Mickey? Because Mickey would have to be the most important character in that movie. Because
he hated Rocky.
No, I know. When Rocky was young and up and coming, Mick shit on him.
Yes.
And so I think it would have to tie into that.
Who would have been perfect, but he died. He died recently. The guy that played Valchek on The Wire.
Oh yeah,
I think he'd have been great.
if you go earlier in the life, you know, then we tell Rocky's backstory. But I don't know. Can there be fighting involved in that? I don't know. It would be interesting. I would
love to see where he's struggling growing up in Philadelphia from a poor family, the whole nine. And you know what? That's something else when you get Stallone involved. Throw a nugget to Stallone. Here's this. Develop this. We're going to give you a certain amount of money. And it ties to you. He's the executive producer or whatever. Because it would only make sense for him to write it, because it's based on a character he created.
All right, I'm going to end with this, and then I'll let you talk about your Life and Times of Muhammad Ali series that you're doing on our Patreon. I just recently learned this, which you remember at the end of Rocky III, Apollo had wanted one favor from Rocky, and that was that they went into the ring and had and sparred.
One second.
And so the movie ends with them both punching each other and freeze frame,
right.
A nice painting of that moment and over. The only thing we know about that moment is the beginning of Rocky IV. Rocky comes into the house with a black eye. And that's all we know.
That's all I remember.
So Stallone, this was probably sometime a couple years back, he actually explained that they had written dialogue for that moment. And in that moment, they both hit each other and they both fall, and Apollo says, "Let's end this in a tie." I'm so happy they never shot that scene.
That would have been horrible. the ending they did show was the better ending. Thank God.
And then in Creed 1, Adonis asked Rocky about that moment, and he says, your dad, Apollo, won, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I want to quickly let's talk about your life and times of Muhammad Ali, because you know I could tell just you know you brought up Ali and his stories in this already a couple times. This is something that is near and dear to your heart.
Yes.
And so explain, because soon after this show is up, we will have the second episode of your Muhammad Ali Patreon. So just explain kind of what you're doing with this series.
The Life and Times of Muhammad Ali Patreon project that I started, you'll have episode 2 coming out soon. It's a homage to my father. Stories that my father told me as a little boy growing up about the times that Ali was on top of the world in the 1960s, the political climate, the whole thing. My father was always telling me exactly what happened. Matter of fact, one of the fights, it won't be one of the fights I cover. I'll talk about it in short detail on episode 3. September 10th, 1966, my parents were married. That night, Ali fought Carl Mildenberger, and the fight was on Wild World of Sports. In the middle of the reception, my parents got married, and in the middle of the reception, the fight comes on, and my father disappeared to watch the fight. So I'll talk more in detail about that on the Patreon podcast. But my father would always tell me what was going on in my parents' life, what was going on in New York, what he could remember about the world. Episode 1, that's already available. I covered the second fight, the Phantom Punch fight between Sonny Liston and Muhammad Ali. And I broke down the controversy and the tension between Malcolm X's new Muslim organization and the Nation of Islam, and how Malcolm was murdered in February of 65. And because of that, the second fight was supposed to happen in April in the Boston Garden, and the Massachusetts and Boston fight commissions were like, no, we're not having this, because we're hearing that Malcolm's people are coming to murder Ali that night. So
oh, wow.
They moved it to Lewiston, Maine, this little place, maybe a 2,500 seat arena. And that night of the fight, they had all types of security and police presence, because the rumor was that Malcolm's people were going to murder Muhammad Ali, because Muhammad Ali had replaced Malcolm X as the quote unquote star of the Nation of Islam. So this is a project near and dear to me. And each fight we do a watch along, and I do play by play for the entire fight. And man, I'm loving this. This is my favorite podcast of the 500 podcasts I do today. It's my favorite one to do, because it everything I do is off memory of what my father told me. I mean, I've studied Ali since I was a little boy, but like I've said, it's not the same if you didn't live in the moment. And I didn't live in the moment, so I'm living vicariously through what my father told me as a little boy. Up until, even when I was an adult, up until when he died 23 years ago, he was always saying, oh, when Ali did this, or Ali did the night Ali did this. Another story that I bring up, when Ali fought Joe Frazier, which is one of the fights I'll talk about, the first fight, the biggest fight in boxing history, March 8th, 1971, my father was incarcerated at the time in Comstock Correctional Facility. That fight was so large, Garrett, that they allowed the prisoners to listen on the U.S., Armed Forces Radio Network, radio feed of the fight.
Wow.
That's how huge that fight. They let prisoners listen on the radio to it.
Wow. All right. So if you want to check that out, patreon.com/fightgamemedia. It's just $5 a month. And there's lots of shows on our Patreon, including some weekly shows. The Dynamite Show, Brace for Impact, and Five Star Joshi Show, all the full shows of those. And then we're doing it about monthly with Robert's show. And then John LaRocque and I are doing it around monthly with our WCW 96.
By the way, Garrett, that Liam O'Rourke interview, I just listened to it yesterday.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
Yeah, he's great.
He's great. Tremendous. Listeners out there, just for that show alone. And Liam O'Rourke is tremendous. We break it with his podcast partner, and you talk about Brian Pillman and how he came up with the loose cannon characters. Yeah. Is great, and how Bobby Heenan didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, crazy.
That guy's great, man. That guy's great. I first heard him years ago when he was talking with Dave. Was it you or Dave?
No, it was Dave and Brian.
David Bryan.
You know what?
Right.
You know what? Let me think about this. That might have been one of the early shows that I was on, because I soon thereafter met Liam in Las Vegas.
In Vegas, was that Cauliflower Alley?
No, it was Starcast.
Starcast, okay.
Which was the same weekend as UFC's Double or Nothing. So okay, that's where I would have met him. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So yeah, thanks to Robert for doing this. As always, great to have you on this show, man.
Much appreciated. And everybody out there, continue blessings.
All right, John, we're going to shut it down. We'll be back in our normal time slot next week, because I won't have a 15-hour drive, though I do have to still go back on Sunday, man. I got to do the 12-hour drive again. But you know what?
You working Monday?
I'm working Monday.
Well, at least you get to work remotely, I think, so you'll be fine.
Yeah, I work from home, so it's not that big of a deal. But lots of podcasts, getting through some audio, and it'll be fine. I mentally can do it. It's a challenge, but mentally, I think I'll be okay. So,
and you better be ready to record on Monday.
Well, that's the other thing to talk to you about.
All right, Tuesday.
We may have to move it a week, because so what John is referring to is our WCW 96 podcast. It is time to talk about Uncensored, and I'd wanted to get caught up this weekend, especially since I'm at my parents' house and stuff, and I just haven't had any time. So I think we'll be able to do it the following week, but that is there's not even that many Nitros, is there?
No, there's a week that they missed, because I think there's some kind of, they're preempted a week as well. So it's not Nitros, and I still gotta watch the main event Uncensored. I actually ended up falling asleep.
Yeah, so we do that on our Patreon if anybody is wondering what we're talking about. We're covering WCW 96. So all right, so we'll be back next week, normal time, Thursday evening, Friday morning, with another episode of the Fight Game Podcast. So thanks to Robert Silva for joining us, and for John, I'm Double G. We'll see you when we see you. Peace out.